Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. Of course, because there's no set schedule, it means that sometimes I read slower, like I have done recently. It's been quite a long time since I've put out an SFBRP podcast, even though I've been putting some other things in the feed, some other podcasts that I've been appearing on as a guest. I hope people don't mind that. I guess I'm not forcing you to listen to them, just sharing other things that I'm doing around the internet, in a way. One thing that I'm really enjoying is goodreads.com. Of course, I talk about this website quite a bit, and I'm always putting up different references there, and I'm really enjoying seeing what other people are reading too. One thing that I noticed, though, I've actually dropped down in one of the things. I'm actually one of the top 168th reviewers, the 33rd best reviewer, the 49th top librarian. I guess I've got librarian status now, and the second most followed person on goodreads.com, although I've got to say that's only in Germany. For a while I was the top most followed person on goodreads.com in Germany, on a non-German book website. I guess you can use it in German as well. Anyway, so yeah, check out goodreads.com. You can follow me there. I'm listed as Luke Burridge, and there's links on the website as well. So check that out, because it's great to get feedback through there and comments on my books that I'm reading, or the books that I'm reading as I go through them too. Oh yeah, also I've listed some of the other books that I've written as well. For a while only one of my books was there, and my second book, my second novel in the Mining Tomorrow series, Combat, is put up there, and only one person's rated it, and they've rated it 2 stars. So if you think it's worth more than 2 stars, Combat that is, get on there and read it. Anyway, today's book is Alas, Babylon. And Alas, Babylon is written by... Oh man, I can't believe this has slipped out of my head here straight away. Yeah, Pat Frank. Not an author that I've ever read before, but what happened is that lots of people said to me, "Hey, Luke, you read Earth Abides, and Earth Abides is post-apocalyptic, and one of the best post-apocalyptic books is Alas, Babylon by Pat Frank." So I thought, hey, well, I'll give it a go. So I started reading. Well, in fact, I didn't read it. I listened to this as an audiobook. I've been reading 2 books at once, one as an audiobook and one as a normal paper book and things like that. And so, yeah, this book has been on my radar for a while, and I saw it on Audible and thought, well, yeah, check it out. And I realized it's not purely a post-apocalyptic book, but I'll get onto that in a bit. So yeah, the setting of this book is 1950s. It was written in the 1950s, 1959. Oh yeah, it's about 11 hours long, I guess, with an audiobook. It says, Goodreads here says 323 pages as well. So it's not a big book, but it is, you know, a decent sized novel. And yeah, so it's written in the 1950s, also set in the 1950s, and we're at the height of like the arms race between America and the Soviet Union, stuff like that. And we read a lot about like the maneuverings of troops and nuclear warheads and carrier groups and aircrafts and submarines and stuff like that. So it's all that kind of stuff. Exactly what you're expecting there, with like sort of like the political setup. It's very, or it seems like it's trying to be very true to life as the perception of life was in the 1950s. And then, of course, there is a war and nukes drop all over the place. But that's to be expected, considering this is being recommended as a post-apocalyptic book, so it's not going to stay. So most of the action actually takes place in a small town in Florida called Fort Repose, and Fort Repose has got a few roads in and out, and it's got a river that flows past it, and it's got a bank, and it's got a few churches and some shops and a hotel where old people, you know, come down from New York or wherever, you know, the north of the United States, to come down to winter, to come down in there instead of hibernating in New York. They come down and migrate down to Florida. And there's a few other things like doctors and shit like that. And just outside of the town is a row of houses alongside the river. And one of these houses belongs to the telegraph operator, which is very handy because then you need to find out about communications coming in and out of the town, so that's cool as well. And there's another house belongs to a couple who recently moved in from out of town, and their daughter lives there with them as well. It's an older couple, and that house is completely modern as well, which is really handy, of course, later on in the book to illustrate some things about modern living after a disaster. And another one belongs to an old Navy commander, which is really handy to have sort of like military knowledge of what's going on as the bombs are dropping and what's going on afterwards as well. He's got a radio, like a shortwave radio, so he you can listen into news as well. And then there's another house that belongs to this poor African-American family who have been living there for many generations and things like that. And that's also handy, which I'll get onto later on too. Finally, there's this large house which is owned by this ex-soldier who fought in Korea, and then he was a lawyer, and his name is Randy Bragg. And at one point, he ran for office. He wanted to become a some kind of, you know, to get into the state legislature or something like that. And he actually owns all of the land in the area, and he gets his money by, you know, from the rent that he gets from other people living on his land, and also the share of the money that's made from the local crops. He owns the land that it's on, so he gets money for that. So he doesn't actually have to worry too much about you know, money or anything. So generally, he just sits around a lot. Anyway, that's this kind of setting. The plot itself is very much, or the story is very much a book of two halves. The first half is the build up to the bombs dropping, which isn't a spoiler, like I say, of course, because that's what the point of the book is. And that half of the story goes a bit like this. Randy's brother works for military Air Force intelligence, and he sends a message to Randy with a quote, "Alas, Babylon," like, "Meet me here, alas, Babylon." And this is a code word. "Alas, Babylon" is a code word taken from the old black preacher who lives next door to Randy. And when they were when Randy and Mark were younger, they always used to go along and listen to this black preacher preaching, and he would talk about revelations and be, "Alas, Babylon, you know, your doom is approaching," or whatever, you know. So all the, you know, revelations kind of apocalyptic, you know, the apocalypse of John, you know, revelations and things like that. So yeah, so Mark uses this, and Mark and Randy use this as a code word to that Mark sort of realizes that, you know, nuclear war would be very bad. So when this is coming up, Mark puts his wife and his kids on a plane and sends them down to Florida, and they arrive in Florida and stay with Randy. And because Mark obviously lives where the, I think it's called the Strategic Air Command, SAC, I think that's what SAC stands for, anyway. And Mark works there, so he gets his family out of harm's way. And meanwhile, Randy gets ready for the bombs to drop, or, you know, in case they do drop. So he's buying up stocks of food and drink and things like that, and buys fuel and all that kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. Also, Randy has a girlfriend who lives just up the street. And yeah, so everything's in place. And that's, you know, all this stuff happens. Lots more happens at the beginning of the book as well. But it's actually quite interesting to see the mindset of people before the bomb drops in this small town setting, and not quite sure what's going on. And Randy's thinking this and thinking that too. And then the bombs drop, and, you know, we get the full reasons for why the bombs drop off, you know, bombs drop, because off in the Mediterranean, there's lots of action going on there between, I think it's Syria and stuff like that, and America's being, and, you know, this, it's all heating up in the Mediterranean and in Turkey and Syria and other places like that. So, yeah, bombs drop, but of course the town where Randy lives and all these people live that he's living with, they all survive. And then the second half of the book, that's when it really gets post-apocalyptic. So it's actually only the second half of this book that I'd call a post-apocalyptic book. And we get the story of what happens in a small town, in a small community after the bombs drop. Fort Repose is probably at this point one of the largest towns remaining in Florida, or so it seems, you know. And there seems to be no way out to the north or the south. Everywhere around is destroyed. Now, I actually enjoyed both parts of this book, and the middle bit when the bombs are dropping, you know, was very effective too, but they definitely feel like completely different from each other. And this is what I've noticed in some other books, because a novel, you can tell different stories over the course of one novel, but if they happen in sequence, these different stories happen in sequence, it's very difficult to keep a through thread because everything changes. You know, like in Earth Abides, that's post-apocalyptic because it starts on the day that there is a disaster. I mean, it's not nuclear disaster, but it starts on that day, and then they have to, you know, the characters have to deal with what happens afterwards. It's the same with The Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham. It starts on the day that a disaster has happened where everyone's gone blind, and that's where it goes. And then there's other post-apocalyptic books like that I've reviewed. So Canticle for Leibowitz is way later and people are trying to sort stuff out. And the same with The Chrysalids too. Of course, they're both nuclear war, nuclear apocalypse, post-nuclear apocalypse books, and yeah, it's people who have had generations to try and sort out what's going on. This book, though, Alas Babylon, has very much the same problem as Lucifer's Hammer, because that, you know, you got all the stuff before the disaster, and the authors think that the most important thing in the book is the disaster and what's going to happen during this disaster, be it rocks from space or be it nuclear bombs or anything like that. And they go into great detail about, you know, where and when and how, you know, what's going on and who's in charge, and, you know, a bit about people preparing and all that kind of stuff. And then after the disaster itself happens, which, you know, could be interesting, you know, it could be exciting or anything like that, there's really nothing to talk about the disaster anymore because the job is done. You know, after the bombs drop, it doesn't really matter what Russia or the USA is doing in this book as long as they don't target Fort Repose, because you don't really want to get right to the very end of the book and then another bomb drops on Fort Repose and it's like, aha, that's it, you're all dead. You know, he's not going to do that. But so the whole dimension of the build-up to the disaster, that sort of that the world is in threat, that there's this global threat there, this dramatic tension that is there in the first half of the book is missing from the second half of the book. You know, and the middle of the book is always interesting as well. Like, it's the same with both of these, but there's like this certain pleasure in reading about millions and millions of people dying completely needlessly, as long as, you know, it's fictional in that way. But, you know, it's really horrific. And that's what horror, you know, horror really does put you on the edge of your seat. You know, as a reader, you go through, it's like, oh, is this city going to survive? When are they going to lose communications here and all that kind of stuff? That's actually interesting. But like I say, when it's over, when all that's over, it's over. And then you've got to find a new story. But if you're going to tell the story after the disaster, it has to sort of rival the tension and the drama of the end of civilization, because that's what we've got here. We've got the end of civilization. And in Lucifer's Hammer, the guys who wrote that, they sort of did that with war and cannibalism, and it sort of did do it because it became a much more personal struggle and things like that, no matter, you know, any other problems that I had about this. Oh, and there's another book as well, Nightfall by Asimov and Silverberg. You know, I read the sort of novel version of that, and it doesn't end when the sun stops shining and everyone goes crazy. Then they say, ah, oh, and now after, here we have this, and it's suddenly like, oh yeah, after the disaster, well, that's suddenly not very interesting anymore, and all of the tension sort of drains out of it, and all of the drama drains out of it. But they try and keep up the tension. They try and, rack up the tension again after the apocalypse. And post-apocalypse, it just isn't that. You've got to tell a smaller scale story. Now, what I actually really liked about this book is that once the bombs drop, Pat Frank doesn't try to instill the same amount of tension and drama after the bombs drop. This story goes in a completely different direction, because the new story that he finds is the story about how Randy stops being this useless failed politician, you know, out of work lawyer playboy kind of guy who likes meeting up with girls around the town and going out and drinking and not actually doing anything. And it's him, and it's his story about how he realizes that the town and his group, his little commune outside of the town, they need a leader. And so it's his journey to hit that realization and trying to, you know, renew the leadership that he showed in Korea and things like that. And and it's really strange because suddenly everything calms down, and that seems to be very much the message of the book, which I'll get onto later. It's sort of like a laid back post-apocalyptic. It's not cozy, as in, you know, people talk about John Wyndham's with his apocalypses. They're always cozy. You know, people get on okay, and you have that a bit here as well. But the challenges that Randy faces and the town faces are difficult. Lots of people do die. It is quite horrific in some ways, but they're sort of barely arduous enough to test Randy. So it's like, it's not like, oh, everything's happened, now I've got to become a leader. It's like, oh, okay, that's a bit bad. Oh, that's a bit bad. Oh, that's a bit bad. Oh, that's a bit bad. Someone should really start sorting. And it's just this really weird slow realization of the, like, this post-apocalyptic small town community of what they actually need to do to survive, and that, you know, there has to be someone in some form of authority. I'm not going to give away what happens at the very end of the book, but there you go. But there is a like I say, there's this lump of tension in the middle, and then slowly sort of peters out. What I'm saying, oh, yeah, I made my note here. Yes, it's by design, I think. Pat Frank is wanting to make things a little bit easier on his characters. He doesn't want to, you know, he puts them through the grinder with the end of the world, but then he starts telling a different story. Which brings me to the characters themselves. Now, to bring out the truth in characters, they have to be tested. Mark, who is Randy's brother, feels like a real human being throughout his part of the story. He's well-rounded because he has to make a really tough decision. He has to send his family away to safety, knowing that he might die, and if the bombs drop, he probably will die. So his character feels, you know, quite strong, and it seems like there's a lot to it. And same with Mark's wife, who I can't actually remember her name now. She feels like a real person because she is like the not the only person experiencing loss, but you know, she doesn't know if her husband is alive or dead, or anything like that. And then it's weird that she starts transferring her affections, you know, and her support or her need for support to Randy. And again, I really felt for her, and I could tell that she was anguished. But and then Randy, our lead character, it's a bit strange because like he seems to be a bit too laid back. And while things do test him and he does grow, it's sometimes a bit strange. He's like, oh yeah, my brother, he might be dead. I don't know if he's dead or not. Oh, well, I just won't think about that now. I've got too much to think about. But then later on, he never seems to, you know, take time to rest and actually think about it. It's like he, you know, doesn't think about mourning the death of humanity, and he sort of just has to get on with things. But then most of the other characters in the book are very, very flat, except for just a few that really stand out. The doctor in here, he's one of the main characters, is good. He's always good. He always does the right thing and things like that. And Randy's girlfriend is loving and completely understanding about like the situation between Randy and his recently widowed sister-in-law, maybe widowed, not going to give it away, but they think that she's widowed and stuff. Then there could have been a real tension there, but actually Randy sort of mostly ignores it, and then it kind of sorts itself out in a way. It's a bit strange, you know. And then there's the family next door, or the other people next door, like the Negro family, as they're referred to, and they sort of seem to just get on quite well after the bombs drop, which is another point of the book, and that the author actually mentions at one point that, you know, the poor black people are actually more suited to post-apocalyptic living because they're already living in a form of post-apocalypse or post, you know, disaster for them and their race, I guess, in 1950s America. They're still trying to come out, and they're still trying to build themselves up as a community and stuff like that. And then a lot of the other characters, like I say, there's nothing, they are tested, but they all seem to rise to the challenge, which in some ways is a bit annoying because, you know, like there's the librarian, and she's happy after the bombs drop because she's like, oh yeah, no electricity, no more TV, no more radio, people are reading more, the library's never been so busy, it's great, you know, and that kind of stuff. And a lot of the other characters, you know, go through this kind of thing, and they actually find a bit more reason for living. They find more motivation after the bombs drop and stuff like that. But it doesn't, like you say, make for that interesting characters. It's an interesting comment about humanity, but the characters themselves are a little bit flat. Another thing about strange thing about the book is that there's no bad guys. I mean, the Russians are bad, but, you know, they're quite faceless. We never see them face to face or anything like that. And then I was thinking, well, what about all the people in the town who are going to be jealous of Randy and his, like, prosperous little community over out there by the river and stuff like that? And I kept on thinking, oh, okay, they're going to turn against him, and they're going to come over and they're going to kill him and they're going to take his food and stuff like that. And it doesn't happen. Nothing happens. At one point, people are going, oh, they're stealing chickens. Who's going to steal the chickens? It could be a dog. It could be a wolf. It could be a person. And we got to shoot them because we can't have them stealing our chickens. We need the eggs. And then, well, I'm not going to give it away, but I'm just like, oh, mild spoilers here. But actually, there's not really very much looting or killing in the town, you know, or by the people who live there, or, you know, or people who live nearby or anything like that. There's some bandits that pass by now and then, you know, but while they kill people, they're sort of just like a mild inconvenience, you know, at worst, they're a mild inconvenience. So it's really strange, actually, that it tells a book about struggles post-apocalyptic, but there's not all of that, oh no, you know, African-American cannibal hordes flowing into the valley or anything like that. And then there's another thing I was thinking, maybe the radiation is the enemy, like it is in The Chrysalids or other post-apocalyptic books. You can't go into the radiated areas and things like that. And there's like a little bit about this in the book, but it's very much a subplot about people who have been looting in the radiated areas and stuff like that. But the river seems to be quite safe and the crops are fine and the milk is good, you know. So once the bombs drop, and sort of cut the town off from the world, there doesn't seem to be very much danger from the bombs, which I guess brings us on to the science and technology, because like post-apocalyptic world is a good setting to deconstruct modern technology rather than invent it. So like telegraphs don't work anymore, old cars work better than new cars because they can be maintained easier and they're better fuel efficiency and stuff like that. Radios work, but they need batteries and stuff like that. And there's bits and pieces about water pumps and like refrigerators and things like that. But because this is sort of like 1950s technology being tested by nuclear war, it's quite quaint, you know. It's interesting. But like I say, bringing it back to the nuclear explosions themselves, there's a bit of discussion about that. But I don't really know if it's realistic or not. It's quite difficult to see, you know, to say what radiation does or what nuclear fallout does and stuff like that. Maybe with these power stations going off in Japan, you know, they're all set to blow at the moment or something. I don't know. Maybe we're going to have another Chernobyl-like experiment with widespread nuclear contamination. Although, by my own knowledge of the power plants that they have, they're probably not. As long as they don't let plutonium gas spread out, I don't mind. Anyway, yeah, what am I trying to say here? Look, notes. Oh, yeah, again, the book seems to let the characters off quite lightly. You know, there would be radiation poisoning and nuclear winter and all these different kind of things that's just not mentioned in the book. Maybe we didn't really know about radiation poisoning so much. Well, I guess we did back then. But, you know, nuclear winter, that many bombs going off. I just don't know what nuclear winter would take to set it off, really. But like I say, that's entirely missing, entirely void from this book. Let me bring on to the writing. The writing is pretty good. It switches between characters in a strange way, though. I kept on finding it. And viewpoints. So it would sometimes be like more of a third-person viewpoint, and sometimes it like a wide third-person viewpoint, and sometimes it would get more closer into the characters and stuff. Thankfully, it's when it switches between different people, it switches between people close to each other, so it doesn't get in the way of the story. Again, when you sometimes, like with a book like Lucifer's Hammer, when they switch between a character here and then to a character over there and then to a character over here and then a character around the world over there and then a character in space and then a character down in the base, you know, and it's difficult because it always breaks up the story and you kind of keep track. This, it keeps switching between people, but they all know each other and they're all, you know, locked in with each other and all in the same situation, which is pretty good. And one thing that I noticed is quite interesting in this book was so often someone will say something or someone will do something or notice something, and I as a good reader or an intelligent reader or something, I don't know what to say about this, but I sort of pick up on that hidden meaning or that double meaning that Pat Frank is commenting on. It's like he's commenting on something else in the story, on another character, on another attitude, on another event, on what somebody has said, and it's quite nice. But then inevitably he always has another character comment on the same thing, as though that person has just made a comment and then one of the characters realizes it, or maybe just the narrator explains the meaning. I can't think of it like an example right off the top of my head right now, but it seems to happen all the time in the book, and I'm thinking, stop doing this, you're explaining too much. Let me work it out, or let the readers work it out. You don't have to spell out all of your little double meanings and little word games that you're playing here within the text. They're so obvious. I mean, they're nice, but they are a little bit obvious at some points. Especially when I've actually gotten someone reading an audiobook and actually explaining it to me. It feels a little bit strange. But then again, it's good in a way, because I don't like, you know, if an author wants to say something, I actually quite like sometimes for them just to say it. Or let me put it this way. If I think I'm picking up on something, it's quite nice to have confirmation that I'm getting everything that the author wants me to think about. And if he isn't mentioning, maybe he doesn't think it's worth talking about. At some point, though, in the book, the dialogue is a bit strained. It's a bit, you know, strange, but it is saved by the narrator. The narrator, Will Patton, very, very good reading. He brings out things in the characters way better than the writing itself brings out the characters. He does lots of good accents and stuff, although mostly it's set in Florida, so he doesn't do strong southern accents as far as I can tell. And there's another thing that he has, which is a really great tiredness to his voice. Now, I've got a bad cold that's just come over in the last few days, but I thought I'd better actually do this review, otherwise it'll just be sitting for another week with no new podcasts up in the feed. So he has this kind of quite cool, gravelly voice, but he, like I say, this tiredness in his voice, which expresses itself when characters start talking. It's like this little small breath that he does when characters are doing dialogue. When he talks, he puts in the characters' breaths, so when they talk they go like this, and he does this little sighing thing. He doesn't do that when in the normal narration. It's so subtle, but it's quite distinct yet subtle at the same time. Once I started noticing it, I thought, oh, this is really great acting. Maybe I'm not explaining it well. Anyway, bring me on to the last thing I normally talk about here in the books that I review, are the main themes of the book. Well, there's different things in it, but the main one that I actually picked out is that disaster can happen after the bombs drop. Things can get better, you know. I mean, or let me put it this way: it's possible for things to get better for some people. This book is, like, you know, very much a book of its time. It's a warning to 1950s America, but it also seems to be a manual of, you know, how to get ready. And it's not like get ready like the characters in this book get ready. It's like get ready learning the lessons that the character in this book know as well, like that. There's water, there's food, you need sort of like forget money and gold and stuff like that, concentrate on a healthy like barter system, collect guns, and, you know, respect the rule of law and get batteries for your radios and things like that. And what I'm saying here is that, you know, things can get better unless they get worse. The message that I get is like, if you're hit by a bomb, you've got nothing to worry about because you're going to be dead. But if you aren't hit directly by the bomb, there's a whole lot of things that you could worry about, but you can't, then you can't affect it. It's like you could worry about what people are doing in other cities, but there's no way to help them. You could be worrying about, you know, radiation, but in a way there's nothing you can do about the radiation. You could be worrying about who's in charge of the government, but you can't worry about that. And you could be worrying about what's happening in the wider world, you know, who's winning the war. Is Russia winning, or what are people doing in China or India or in Europe or anything like that, or what are people doing in South America? You could worry about that, but you can't affect it. So what you got to do is get on in making your life better where you are. And it's a bit strange. Oh, I made another note here as well. It's a little bit progressive in some ways too. It says, you know, race, don't worry about race when the bombs drop. Everyone's going to be equal. And in fact, as they say in the book, the Negroes could be better off than the white folks down in Florida and stuff like that, because they're more used to it. They're sort of more of a subsistence level anyway. I guess that's one of the messages here in the book. And religion, don't worry about religion. Money, don't worry about money. These things matter before the apocalypse, before the bombs drop, but after, you know, only humanity matters, only resourcefulness matters and stuff. But funnily enough, in this book, gender still matters after the bombs drop, unless you're a small girl, because, you know, if you're a woman, you stay in your place, you cook, you do that kind of stuff, and only the men go out and do stuff. Even, you know, race doesn't matter, religion doesn't matter, money doesn't matter, social standing doesn't matter, but gender does still matter, girls. Sorry about that. So, like I say, bring it back to this main theme as well, I've got confused. I'm looking at my notes here as well. USA. Oh, yeah. In the end, we get USA obliterated by bombs, or meet, like, as much as it matters to the people who survive down in Florida, the USA might as well not exist anymore. But those who survive seem to be the true Americans. They're independent, and but yet they still sort of need or want strong authority or something. And they're sort of capitalists. They're all going, yeah, making money and stuff like that. We get a lot of that at the beginning of the book. And then even when there's no such thing as capital, it's still about trade and stuff like that, and free markets too. A lot of the second half of the book, even when money doesn't exist anymore. And there's, you know, stuff about keeping the law and, you know, the right to have guns and, you know, and getting married and having children and looking after the front lawn and your white picket fence. And I'm not kidding there, by the way. Actually, Randy kept the front lawn of his house mowed even after the bombs dropped. He says, yeah, this is like a symbol of normality. This is a symbol of the American way. So this book is very much, yay, America, yay, the American way of life. Because no matter about the bombs or anything like that, the American dream, the American lifestyle is the one that's most suitable to post-apocalyptic living. So stick with it, America. It doesn't matter if the bombs drop. Keep being American. Dun, 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 dun. Of course, this is from the 1950s, so it's an understandable message, but it does come across to me that's one of the main themes of this book. It's like, don't worry about the other people. Don't worry about the things you can't affect outside. And yet also keep being American, because the American kind of way is the thing that'll get us through as a community, as a family, as a human being, and just as a philosophy or something like that. So what else do I have here? Oh yeah, it's written 10 years after Earth Abides. That was written in 1949. This book was written in 1959. And in some ways, it's a little bit of a step back in some ways in terms of themes and ideas, but it does have just a completely different flavor and a completely different message to it too. But then again, it was written before Lucifer's Hammer. But it seems to be way ahead in terms of, you know, the treatment of race, you know, within the book. Maybe not by the characters themselves. No, even by the characters themselves. It seems to be very much like that. So it's a bit strange. I think it's, like I say, it's definitely a book of its time. What was I trying to say? I was comparing it to Lucifer's Hammer somewhere. Sorry about this. I keep wanting to cough and losing concentration. Nope, that thought has completely gone. Oh yeah, I'm just saying that actually the outlook of humanity in this book, while maybe a bit naive and maybe a bit white picket fence, I actually like it a whole lot better to have a post-apocalyptic book where people don't turn to cannibalism, no matter how bad it is. They actually do keep their humanity. They don't keep their humanity at the expense of turning away everyone from the valley and killing lots of black people. They keep their humanity actually by keeping their humanity and welcoming people and helping people and things like that. So I really do like the overall message of this book, no matter how yay America it is. In the end, though, this book is very dated in almost every single aspect. I think it was one of the first like popular portrayals of nuclear war and the aftermath in like written fiction as a novel. I think, you know, that's what people tell me about this book anyway. I haven't really looked it up myself or done that much research into the writing of the book or what the other post-nuclear apocalyptic books were at the time. But today, it does definitely read as a piece of history, not like alternative history or something like that, but as a piece of history, as like what the book would mean to the people who read it at the time. Let me just put it this way: War of the Worlds stands up today because the themes that the War of the Worlds expresses are universal. You know, they apply to everyone, and the themes of other post-apocalyptic books can stay universal because the themes are universal, or they can stay popular because the themes are universal. Alas, Babylon, I think, is the opposite, because the themes are very much 1950s America, very much 1950s America, and there isn't a whole lot outside of that which would appeal to the wider audience, I don't think. Well, that's the way I get it. But it is a great glimpse into that mindset and the sort of the worries of 1950s America, you know, at the time. But, you know, the relevance to today is a little bit harder for me to pick up on. In the same way, I guess, that I really struggled with Canticle for Leibowitz, because it was written for a mindset of person which just isn't me, and so not me that I probably didn't get that book as well as I could. I think I do sort of get this book, but I actually enjoyed it as more of like a historical thing. I'm 30, and I distinctly remember being told about like the possibility of nuclear war as a child, you know, the 4-minute warning and stuff like that. I remember reading a book when I was quite young, actually after 1989 and sort of the end of the Cold War, called Zed for Zachariah. And I remember, so that's a post-apocalyptic book, bombs fall, like one survivor or two survivors in the world, one family survives in this world. I should look that up. I was reading that book, and this was just a few years after the end of the Cold War, and I was thinking, wait a second, we don't need to worry about this anymore, you know? And that was just a few years later, you know, when before, you know, as a family, we were talking about, oh yeah, if the bombs drop, what would we do? Would we survive? I remember living in York and thinking, yeah, would York be hit, or would we have to worry in York? What would happen there? You know, where would we go, and all that kind of stuff. It was like dinner table conversation. And then afterwards, it didn't take long, and we're just thinking, well, this would never happen. We don't need to worry about this kind of stuff. It's just stupid, that mutually assured destruction. So it's a bit strange. Anyway, like I say, this appeals to me on some levels, but appeals to sort of like the 9-year-old Luke rather than the 30-year-old sort of growing up in a modern world kind of Luke. I'm going to give this book 3.5 stars. I enjoyed the first part, I enjoyed the middle part, I enjoyed the last part. It was a bit uneven throughout, which sort of soured the book for me. But I, like I say, individually, I liked it all. And I don't really have a lot of complaints. So there you go, 3.5 stars to this book. And that's after a string of like 2.5 star books for recently. I think the more good books I read, the more I get into reading and the more I want to do these podcasts. So maybe I need to get onto some books that I know I'm going to enjoy and start reviewing them a bit quicker for you people to listen to, reading and reviewing. But my life is so busy at the moment. I'm actually at home. I always think, yeah, when I get home, I'll do lots of stuff and this. But when I'm traveling, I actually have way more time. When I'm actually working on cruise ships and traveling around the world, I'm traveling a lot more, so I'm listening to more audiobooks, and when I'm sitting around in the cabin, I have a lot more time for different projects, which is strange. But I do actually have another book finished. I just finished it this morning. It's called Forbidden Knowledge by Stephen R. Donaldson. It's the second book in the Gap series, and I bet you people can't wait for that review, considering how much I disliked the first book in that series. Anyway, stick around for that. Email me, luke@juggler.net, if you've got any book recommendations, or if you want to comment about this review or anything like that, or any conversation that you want to have. I do reply to every single email that I receive. And of course, because I've not done many podcasts recently, I've not got many emails. Also, follow me on goodreads.com. That's the best way to keep up to date with the books that I'm reading and reviewing. And, you know, and I say I put updates whenever I, you know, every day or every few days, I say where I'm up to in the books that I'm reading, and I get quite a few comments there, which is great. And also, I want to see what you guys are reading too. Like I can do here, 12 friends have listed Alas Babylon here, and it gets a 3.71 average, which is pretty much close to my 3.5 average. Yeah, not many people. Sandy says, I read Alas Babylon during a vacation to Mammoth at the end of August 2005. We had no TV, no newspapers, and no radio for 4 days. It's a bit like in the book. When we got home, we learned about the destruction caused by Hurricane Katrina. Oh, wow. Oh, well, I don't think I want to carry on reading here as well. But, you know, oh yeah, as I watched the news reports, it's not a very long review, as I watched the news reports about the aftermath, I kept thinking back to the incidents in this book. It was just a bit spooky, and it made me realize how unprepared I am for a major disaster. It also made me wonder if it's even possible to be truly prepared for a disaster. Maybe it's your character and intelligence that determines if you survive and how you live afterwards. Which, yeah, that's specifically the point of this book. And I guess we could say the same thing with this new earthquake and tsunami in Japan at the moment and stuff like that. I don't know how it's gonna sort itself out, but you know, reading this book, would it prepare you for a disaster? Maybe. I don't know. It's a bit strange, but like this book says, it's very much about character rather than character after the event rather than preparation before the event, because you never really know how bad it's going to be or what you're going to need, but your character afterwards is a seminar. Yeah, so thanks a lot for running. She's the only person who actually wrote a review of this book. Everyone just gave it stars or marked it as to read. That's why you should look up, so I should get on goodreads.com so I can see what you think about books that I'm reading or I'm about to read or have read and stuff like that. I am interested. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm actually not updating Twitter very much at the moment for some reason. I don't know. It's just not really in my mind. Or go to my blog. Oh, yeah, Luke Burridge at Twitter. No, at Luke Burridge. On twitter.com/LukeBurge. Also lukeburge.com/blog. Follow along with everything I'm doing. Mostly I'm posting photography stuff on my blog at the moment and some videos. On my next trip, which I'm going back to the Amazon in a few weeks' time, of course I'll be doing more stuff and having more output on my blog, so check it out too. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.